The investigations went on, and I don't know, I can't remember now how many months, years, weeks, charges and countercharges, but finally in a September, I think it was September, October faculty meeting, the resolution was coming from the faculty committee on fraternity and sorority regulations, I've forgotten the name of that committee, that Wisconsin withdrawal recognition of Delta Gamma, because they obviously practice segregation. The Dean of Women's Office got into it, was in it all the way along, although not all that much. The local Delta Gamma chapter said, as far as they knew, there was no regulation and that they could pledge a black girl if they wanted to. National simply said was that the charter had been withdrawn from Beloit because they didn't conform with national regulations, and it was sort of impasse. I went over to Beloit and talked with President Upton and visited with people over there. It was apparent that most of the people at Beloit, and I could confirm this after I went back to be president of Beloit, believed that it was Patty Hamilton's pledging that led to this. If they hadn't pledged Patty Hamilton, that National would continue to work along with them and would have sent someone out, you know, to bring them into line. So the people of Beloit that I talked to were firmly convinced that Patty Hamilton's pledging, although the reasons were placed on other causes, Patty Hamilton's pledging was what led them to crack down on the Beloit chapter. Well, I came back and we were, I spent some time talking with a good many people. I tried to talk with people in Delta Gamma, and must say that I was disappointed at their lack of forthcomingness. The president was in, and I tried to talk to alumni, and the president literally sat with her mouth closed saying, I can't even remember who was the president of the chapter, but saying, I can't say anything. I think emotionally I was pretty disturbed about the whole thing, thought probably the faculty committee was right, and was plenty upset that the local officers took the attitude of, we cannot talk to, we've been told by National we can't talk to the Dean of Women's Office, we cannot confide in them.
Why not?
Well, they just had been told, and so this girl sat there just, and I was pretty upset about that because I thought we were there and I was perfectly willing to take the role of defending the best interests of the students and wasn't really going to be swayed by the faculty or National Delta Gamma. Whatever we could work out that was best for the students was the position I thought I had to take. But after some weeks of worrying about it, I finally said to Mr. Harrington that I believed that the faculty committee was wrong, that I thought they were dealing on circumstantial evidence, that while I believed it was true that the charter was suspended and that I doubted that the Beloit chapter or that the Madison chapter could pledge a black girl, although I'd be interested in seeing them try it, I doubted that they could. I didn't think there was any rule in the Constitution that forbade it, and that if the Madison chapter did it, they might be strong enough to get away with it. But I still felt that we would be in an awkward position, the faculty would, if they went on record for suspending the chapter on the basis of this kind of lack of clear-cut information. Mm-hmm. And so I went before the faculty, and at that point, when I can remember, and I can still remember that afternoon, it was over in an auditorium, business school or someplace, and I can still remember the dress I had on, I can still remember everything. I hadn't been long in Wisconsin. But I got up, and I think the whole faculty, I had the feeling the whole faculty was going to vote to suspend. And here sat Freddie Sisk and Mrs. Coleman and all the stalwarts of Delta Gamma. They'd asked to come to the faculty meeting, and Mr. Harrington had asked me, and I said, let them come. I got up and made the statement, and you had the statement, I don't even remember it, but I think it said some of the things I've said now. While I didn't doubt the accuracy, I thought this would be a most unwise move for the faculty, and recommended that they not vote in support of the resolution from the faculty committee, and sat myself down. And I sat down, and I remember, I don't know by whom I was sitting, saying, look at me, Patty Peterson from Jamestown, Kansas, up here sassing the University of Wisconsin faculty. I had a feeling of just, you know, complete. And then a vote was taken, and the motion from the faculty committee was defeated, which was not too usual in that faculty. And I was rather relieved, because I thought we had taken maybe not the noblest path, but we had taken the path that was justified and that probably led for the greatest future opportunity of developing some strong relationships. And so I was pretty relieved that day. What has always amazed me since is to hear from some of the women who were there that day, or Delta Gamma alumni, that I was an enemy of sororities and that I did my best to get Delta Gamma off the Wisconsin campus. And I've been told by a son of one of the women who was a Delta Gamma, as he got to know me, and we were awfully good friends, he said, you know, you don't seem much to have horns to me. And I said, what made you think? He said, he happens to be a trustee at Beloit and voted to hire me down there. And I said, what made you think I had horns? Well, what you did to Delta Gamma. And of course, I looked upon myself as the person that stopped the University of Wisconsin faculty from doing Delta Gamma in. But that was an interesting period. And of course, I think I felt then that in the long run, this was going to be the issue 20 years from now that no one was going to worry much about. It would go down the drain, and that the faculty would be very ill-advised to pick a fight on that scale as something that was going to go out.
Well, how do you feel in the light of that many years later, what has developed?
I think undoubtedly National Delta Gamma was not about to see a black girl pledged. I have no qualms about that. I think that the Wisconsin faculty took the right move.
Mm-hmm. How about today?
I have not kept that much touch. I do know that many fraternities and sororities have pledged black gals, and they've pledged Chinese and Oriental. I'm not sure. I hear every once in a while of a fraternity or sorority now, but I'm pleased with this, a fraternity or sorority now who just come right out and say, we want no one occasions. All right? If they want to say that, and then it's up to the university to decide whether they want to permit them to be on the campus, and I happen to admire those that have come out and said firmly, I don't agree with them, but said firmly, this is our policy, then I think that puts it back in the laps of the faculty and the university, and I would then vote to say, no, you can't be on our campus.
That's much more clear-cut situation.
Yeah, that's clear-cut. It was a messy situation 20, 30 years ago when groups that were not connected with the college were making policies that affected what happened on the college. It made much more sense at Wisconsin to be able to pledge black people or people of other races and creeds, Jewish people, and so on. It made much more sense at Wisconsin than maybe it would have at the University of Georgia. And there were a lot of fraternities and sororities that it has to be a policy that fits your campus and your situation. I can live with that. I can live with the ones that just say, no, we won't do it. And then I think Wisconsin doesn't have them on the campus, and maybe the University of Florida does have them. And our University of Georgia, if they want them. But it was a rough and awkward time. And I guess I'm still amazed at the number of people who say to me, you were anti-sorority and anti-Delta Gamma. And I always felt in my relationships with sororities and fraternities that I was trying to provide some leadership to make them fit with the modern times so that they could exercise those things that they did well, which was the smallness of group relationships. And I thought they made some contributions, but when they became socially elite, excluding people because of money or race or creed, I thought they were making a mistake that they wouldn't continue to thrive in the late 80s and the 90s. And I think that's probably been proven true.
While we're still on the subject of sororities, I've been found myself wondering how your views with regard to these organizations differ from, or were the same, from those of Ted Zellman, who was a strong supporter of them.
I suppose I was more relaxed. I was not a member of a sorority. I had worked in a system at Kansas that was that needed opening up. And the people who wanted me to open it up there and who stood with me were fraternity and sorority members who felt that it had become so dominating in the social life of the university, that it was doing, keeping people away from the university, interfering with the intellectual life, and oh, there are all kinds of strange things at Kansas in the late 40s, well, I suppose it's true in the 30s when I was a student there, that if you belong to one or two or three groups, then in both of these were the top three sororities and the top three fraternities, then if you were a pledge, you had to get so many points the people you dated. And if you dated people out of the top three groups, you could get 3 points for dating. If you were in the second three groups, you got 2. If you were in the lower groups, you got 1. And if you weren't a fraternity or sorority member, you got 0, which meant then that the pledges really couldn't date anyone because they couldn't gather their points. Dating and not, well, it was a funny, rigid system. It was a system of pledging. It was just chaotic and anarchic. Oh, just all the bad things you can say. All right, the people there who cared about fraternities and sororities in the sense that they were a house in which 40 or 50 people live, where they learn to know faculty members, where they worked with adults, where they had certain kind of standards they lived by, where they were well cared for, where they were in an adjunct to the university and providing housing, good housing. Well, there were a lot of things they did well. There were people who saw that and wanted to preserve that, but knew if they went on the other route, they were just headed for, that they couldn't be sustained. And so that I was perfectly willing to be a part of that. When I came to Wisconsin, that issue of elitism wasn't so much important in fraternities and sororities, but the issue of discrimination was. And again, I think that was an issue that fraternities and sororities had to face. And so, as I look back on it, I think that when they served the purposes they started to serve, and when they provided this kind of support, it was they were very good. There were a lot of times they did some very bad things, and you could see things get started in houses. I think of one campus I know fairly well, where. The amount of drinking you do and are able to, how much you can cope with liquor and how drunk you can get over a weekend is the pattern of fraternity membership. That's very bad.
Yes, I would agree.
That's terribly bad. And the people, the administrators of that campus are worried sick about it. It's a problem. So that those kind of excesses can grow out of it depending on who you get in it. But a good organization, well organized, with good people, with good alums who advise and help, and a good national, it can be a very real asset. Ted was very loyal all the way. He thought that the University of Wisconsin would be very bad without fraternities and sororities. I thought it could survive without them. But I was glad to see them there if they would do the things that they could do best that couldn't be done in dormitories, I didn't think. And certainly wasn't done in a rooming house out in town. So we differed on it.
There was, it seems to me, a time when, you suggested when you were in college, for instance, when sororities and fraternities were very popular and very important in student life, then it seems to me that there was something of a decline, and now my impression is that they're gaining again in popularity. How do you account for the decline?
I think some of those regulations that they put on that the nationals were insisting that were out of another generation just weren't acceptable to the students on the college campus. And so it was a part of that, and it could be related to discrimination, or it could be related to how you dress for dinner, or how you entertain the national officer, but there was a lot of requirements there that didn't fit with the generation of students that were coming along, and so they didn't need that. They didn't need it either because the people on the college campus were more individuals. They weren't so much we didn't have much dormitory group life in that period when they were rejecting sororities. It was awful hard to get students in that period when they rejected them to be awfully loyal to a group. They were striking out, doing their own thing, developing their own kind. And they got their group loyalty and satisfaction out of sometimes political causes or other issues that came up off campus often, not on campus. I think that that period of decline led to a lot of major adjustments in parts of fraternities and sororities. Some of them had to give up their houses. They had to do some things differently. They're coming back now, I think, because there is a need, a resurgence of interest in groups and belonging to groups and doing things with groups. I hope some of the silly things that were there that turned people off are out of the picture. If they aren't, if the sororities and fraternities nationally and as alum groups haven't become more flexible, I suspect they will go through another decline. But I hope they've adjusted so that they can provide that support and that kind of relationship. And there are a lot of people who love the ritual. Although I must say, as I hear people describe the ritual in sororities and fraternities now, it's changed considerably from what it was 30 years ago. You can miss a chapter meeting now. Well, 30 years ago, you missed a chapter meeting, you were awfully tall. And so it's a change in the time.
Just generally less rigid, like a lot of other things.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see. They're growing more, apparently, on smaller campuses and in the south than they are in the north. I don't know what's happening in the Wisconsin campus. I really haven't observed enough to know. But I hear there's added strength in Wisconsin.
This is an impression I get. Mm-hmm. That's, I'm not closely connected with them either, so I'm not certain of just how or why.
Well, I came out of a campus in a situation that, right now, if you were to ask me, did I know so-and-so at Kansas, I would probably say, oh yes, he was Sigma Chi, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. That was the kind of thing, that was the way you categorize people, the house they lived in Kansas. And we have people come in to shop up here. And one of the first things they'll say, you know, I was a DU at Kansas, you used to come over to dinner. That never happened at Wisconsin, as far as, in fact, by the time I came to Wisconsin, you had to ask four times whether they were a member of fraternity or a sorority, and they didn't wear their pins. At Kansas, it was a whole different kind of thing.
Do you suppose the size of the University of Wisconsin might have had something to do with that?
Size and the progressive, you know, that kind of spirit that permeates Wisconsin. I think it does, the kind of spirit that recognizes a person for ability and interests and honesty. I don't want to say Kansas is dishonest, but Kansas was a new state. Mm-hmm. And there was very little social hierarchy there. And this provided it. Wisconsin, there are other things you claim fame to.
Well, I rather imagine that Kansas was representative of a number of state colleges that operated in a similar way.
And Kansas was a free state, to be critical, and people who didn't like this, newspaper editors and so on, they spoke out against it, and that was one of the reasons the university had to change. There were just enough people who were, they speak pretty freely what they think about in Kansas. I'm going to have to get ready to go to the shop shortly.
One thing I'm interested in is a conference that occurred in 1962 on the continuing education for women, and this is a subject that interests me quite a bit. I'd be interested in your reflections on that. And on continued education for women.
Which
anyway,
one was it? It seems
it doesn't
to me.
Matter of which one. I just noted that there was one then, and I know mm-hmm. there were others. The idea of it, basically, is what I'm interested in.
Well, let me just briefly outline what we did in the Dean of Women's office, maybe, and I think that's what led up to the conferences. We talked a lot about what we should be doing, not so much for continuing education, but for older women in the community, for people who were seeking new ways of learning and that kind of thing, and jobs. And one of the first things that we did was hire Ruth Doyle to come into the office, and her job was half-time, but it was to work with women who, and we didn't define them as older, but by our very rules they were older, women who lived out in town. Not at home as much, but rented rooms out in town, and you really had to be, I've forgotten what age now, 20 it seems to me, or 21, before you could rent a room, unsupervised room.
Off campus
housing. And Ruth came in to work with that. She came in to work with minority groups. She really wrote her own ticket of what she wanted to work with, where she felt she'd be comfortable. She worked with Madison students too, ones who lived at home, and seemed just a real asset to me to find Ruth. And there was some things we needed to do in the office that we'd sort of been doing out of her side pocket, and Ruth worked on those. Then finally she became really interested in talent of a lot of people, talents that she thought were being wasted. Kay Clarenbach came back to Madison about that time, and we talked about what we might do in this area, and finally, after much, you know, taking on the whole world, decided it would be very interesting to do a survey of wives of faculty members. And I think we did wives of lawyers and wives of doctors, groups that we could get a hold of easily, the mailing list, because we had no money to do it, groups we could get a hold of easily. Survey. And so then I went to Fred Harrington and said we wanted to do this and we need money to print up the questionnaire, and we can mail it through the campus mails, but to the doctor's wives and lawyer's wives we'd have to have postage stamps. And so he gave me $500. And Ruth, who was working, and Kay volunteered her efforts, and two or three other people worked on it, put together a questionnaire. And it was simply a survey of what jobs they'd had, what educational level they had, whether they were interested in employment, what they'd like to do that they weren't doing, what were their plans for the next 10, 15 years. It brought in a lot of interesting information. I think my first reaction when these people got it summarized was the talent there was out there, real talent that wasn't being used at all, people with all kinds of abilities. And some of them were abilities that we were constantly having calls. Do you have anyone who can do this kind of thing? We have this job that needs to be done and we can't find anyone to do it. So then I think we hired Kay, got a little money to hire Kay Clarenbach.
Oh.
And we began just doing the simple things that you could do of somebody wanted this kind of a person to work for them, and there were three women that met these qualifications, so calling that person and saying, why don't you call these three women and see if you could work out anything. There was a group of them that wanted to upgrade their teaching degrees, certificates, so they could teach, and they were well qualified, but they didn't have a certificate in Wisconsin. And so I remember when ordered Lindley Stiles, and very shortly about 20 or 30 of them were enrolled in courses. Took no doing. It just was a matter of getting them together. So we did a lot of simple things of that kind. Then the first conference came out of that, and where we had limited our survey to people we could get our hands on cheap and easy, who were likely to be among the most qualified. Mm-hmm. The conference was thrown open, and then began all kinds of things out of it. But some of the interesting things I remember happening, I remember discussions where there were people who wanted to work part-time. And the reaction was, you can't have part-time teachers. You have to have a full-time person. And then some people in the school system began willing to say, well, if we can find two people who will do this job each half day, maybe we're better off than if we insist on a full-time person. We went to Carnegie about that time and got the money for the E.B. Fred Fellows and began to solicit those applications. And Kay Clarenbach worked on that. And a good many women who wanted to finish their PhDs in different areas were named E.B. Fred Fellows. And this gave them enough money, and the money could go for babysitting, it could go for housework. It didn't have to go just for their expenses in coming to the university, but that program got started. So my interest was at that level of trying to work with individuals in finding ways. I think of a Helen White comment early on about students and about people, women particularly of this kind. Her statement was, the university can meet almost all their needs if you can figure out a way to cut the red tape in their lives and in the university. And so that was the level at which I always concentrated. I was not really very much interested in organizing group attacks on prejudice or so on. I was more interested in trying to find a way that the resources of the university might be fitted with the needs of people and the questions people had and the talents they had. And so that was the way we worked all the time.
Well, it takes some imagination to see ways around existing situations.
And Helen White was absolutely marvelous on this. I heard her make this statement fairly early on. She said, the university can do almost anything, but you have to learn to cut the red tape. And she said, I spend most of my time as a chairman of the English department cutting red tape so that the person can do what's sensible to do.
Well, that's a great attitude, it seems to me.
And I can remember calling her from time to time and would say, I've got this particular problem. It makes sense for this girl to do this. What do you think? Makes sense. Now, and then you figured out a way.
How do we do it?
Yes. How do we do it? And you figured out people you could always count on. You always knew there were some people, and I have no objection to these people. We absolutely were going to follow the letter of the law. You did never bother to call them. You called someone else who didn't worry about the letter of the law, who was perfectly willing. And that was the kind of approach I used in continuing education always, that it wasn't so much prejudice. It was just figuring out a way to adjust rules that were made for another purpose so that people could do what was sensible.
How did you feel about these governors' conferences? Do you feel they were effective or useful?
I think so, yes. My concern about that is that you repeat them too often, you get the same people coming and nothing ever happens, and if you begin to see nothing productive is happening. Conferences, show and tell sessions, seminars starting, maybe all right to raise consciousness, that's a good enough word. There's nothing wrong with it. But you got to do more in this business than raise consciousness. And you better be ready to take the next step. And sometimes just raising a person's consciousness doesn't give them the tools that enables them to take the next step. Sometimes what you do is make them just unhappy with what they've got without giving them any way to move.
Well, there are a couple of occasions, annual affairs, I gather, at the university that I'd just like you to sort of briefly describe a little bit what goes on and what you think their value of the student body might be. One is the annual senior swing out.
Mm-hmm. Swing out during the periods I was at the university was an event in that curious position of having been very, very popular, very important, and still viewed with respect as a very fine tradition. And yet, each year, there was always a question, is this passé? Should we really be doing this? First, it was for women, honoring women, and secondly, it was a kind of an event that had gotten a little out of style. It didn't swing exactly, even though it was swing out. It wasn't that kind of an event. And it was the honors convocation in Wisconsin tradition, in the Wisconsin tradition, and for women. And mortarboard was announced there, and all the women's honors, and that sort of thing. When I was there, I think with the exception of one year, we were always able to have it on Bascom Hill, and that contributed to the beauty of it. There was a form of what you did. We passed from the daisy chain kind of thing that I think they used to have with it to a fairly straightforward presentation of honors and comments. I remember one year we had it in the Union. Always when it was over, there was a glow. Not mobs of people came, but parents came, and students came, and faculty members came, and it was a Saturday afternoon, beautiful on Bascom Hill. I can remember some lovely days in early May when we did it, and people were always pleased. And then you went through the next months getting the swing out chairman and getting people organized, and everyone saying, oh, I'm not sure this fits with the 1960s, or I'm not sure this is the kind of thing we should be doing. But we continued to do it. I don't know whether they still do it or not, but I knew it at the time that it was a little out of step with the times. And yet it was pretty well respected, and always enjoyed doing it, and the students always liked it when it was over. A lot of work.
They sort of worked on it all year.
Oh,
to get ready,
the committees,
for...
and they worked on it all year. Mm-hmm.
Well, another thing to have it checked, but I don't think we talked about it, was annual Women's Day. What did that come out to?
That had gone a bit by the board by the time I was there. I think I recall one or two. They at one time were meant for career planning to stimulate young women to think about careers and to bring in all sorts of, I believe this is what the annual Women's Day was, and to stimulate all bringing in, or we brought in distinguished women, they did. By the time I was there, at Wisconsin, I think we did one or two, and I think we tried them in several forms. Meeting every evening for a week, or at a meeting all day. But the interest had dropped off, and I don't believe we did over one or two or three, and then we would do just fairly simple events of an afternoon and have someone in and try to stimulate interest in students. But it was not much of an annual affair when I was there.
That's interesting, because this was at a time, it seems to me, when women were getting more and more active in women's rights movements and things of this sort.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
Meanwhile, Women's Day was going down the drain. Now, I'd like to move on to several conferences or committees that I've discovered you were on that I'd like to know a little bit more about. One was something described as a 12-member committee on international exchange of persons, and I'm curious to know what your responsibilities on that were.
I think that was a three-year appointment from the American Council on Education. Four national groups, National Academy of Sciences, American Council of Learned Societies, American Council on Education, and one of the foreign scholarly exchange groups, and I've forgotten what one that one was. Each had three representatives on this commission, and I was one of the American Council on Education representatives. Our job was to appoint the Fulbrights, select the Fulbrights for recommendation to the Board on Foreign Scholarships. The Fulbright, those professors who applied to be a Fulbright professor were first screened, and then our committee of 12 Twice a year, I think, we met. Went over the applications at least twice a year, maybe three times a year. But went over the applications that had been screened, we'd have a group, and tried to fit them with the needs of the countries. If Australia wanted geologists and 17 geologists had applied, we'd try to pick out the ones that would fit best in that exchange. And then we recommended them to the Board of Foreign Scholars, and they confirmed the appointments, and rarely did they do anything but confirm. But ours was the final selection committee for Fulbright. And I think I served on it 3 years. Farrington Daniels was a representative of the National Academy of Sciences at the time I was on. Farrington and I were both on at the same time.
Now, is this a continuing arrangement?
As far as I know, Fulbright isn't being funded as well.
Oh, what is?
As it was. But as far as I know, that group still operates. Mm-hmm. Very interesting equipment.
Well, while I'm thinking about the Fulbright group, then there's something known as the Annual Midwest Conference of Fulbright Scholars and University Professors.
Mm-hmm.
What was its function?
Well, at the time that I was a member of that commission, the board, that commission, I was asked to be chairman of this Midwest Conference. And every year, the Washington office of this committee sponsored conferences across the country in different sections, usually in three areas, I think, for those people who had come from overseas, Japanese and Australians and Finnish and so on, who had been visiting scholars here and were going home. And so before they went home, they would have a conference for them on some campus or other college campus, bring them all together before they departed for home. And one year we had the Midwest Conference at the University of Wisconsin. And that grew out of that other appointment. They asked me if I would chair it and if we'd do it at Wisconsin, and we said we would, and we did it. But it was an annual affair that's held different places. And it was very interesting. State Lowell Hall, as I recall it, and we had about 100 people. We tried to do things to get them to talk about their experience in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also tried to give them a last experience that they shared together on a college campus. So the people from the University of Wisconsin that they might hear about when they got home, we made sure they met them. We brought in people, I think the University of Chicago and other places that they had met through the year. It was just kind of sort of final farewell.
Nice send-off.
Yes, nice send-off. And it was great fun. I remember the evening that a kind of informal dinner. We asked the people who were coming, wrote them a note ahead of time, and asked them that night if they would make a presentation of what they would like to have us most remember about their country, when we thought about their country. And they could bring pictures, they could bring artwork, they could bring anything. They could just stand up and talk. And that is one of the most interesting evenings I've ever had. I can remember one young man from Japan who was a chemist talked about Japanese food, and he'd gotten some examples of Japanese food. And this was what he longed for most from his country. And you could just almost see his mouth watering. But it was experiences of that kind that they talk about their own country in terms of what they'd like to have those of us there remember about their country or think about their country. It was interesting. Lots of people in Wisconsin worked awfully hard on it. I can remember Carl Prill was in the president's office at that time, and we were going to have a picnic out at Fish Hatchery Farm, and fried chicken and all that kind of thing, a typical picnic. And the people who were supposed to help serve it didn't have any people to work. So Carl Creel and Maxine Bennett and Joe Prouty and Chuck Engman and a whole lot of people at the university went out and actually did the serving, the dishing, and the working of it. And some of these foreign scholars just couldn't believe it. I think the union was to serve it, or someone was to serve it, and the students who were to do it just didn't appear. And so we just pressed into labor. The university officials, we had a fine time doing it, but I can remember, and I remembered Carl Creel in particular, because once one of the visiting scholars came up and said, isn't that Mr. Creel who does all this work, who's a dean of graduate school or something, and, you know, he's been this, mm-hmm. Isn't that he serving mashed potatoes or something?
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's educational in itself. Don't
yes.
how we work on occasion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's one other thing. It's the Rennebaum Foundation Educational Development Project, that known as RED, gathered, which seemed to have been, from what I read about it, a 5-year project involving schools around Wisconsin.
I really don't know much
about that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I was a part of that.
Well, somebody suggested you might have been.
No, I don't think so.
I
think I vaguely remember what it did. And wasn't Bill Sewell a part of that?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. But I was not really involved in it. Someone probably mentioned it, because one summer, and this was not a part of the Rennebaum, although we may have been funded out of the Rennebaum project, I think we were. One summer, we did an analysis of all the high schools in Wisconsin. It was while I was assistant to the president, I think, after I'd been dean of women. We did an analysis of all the high schools in Wisconsin, number of graduates, number who went on to college, number who came to the University of Wisconsin, number who went to the centers, that kind of an analysis mm-hmm. of the high schools from records, and to try to get a picture of those schools that seemed regularly related to the university and the university system, those schools where they were underrepresented in higher education, where there might need to be some work done, where students were, graduates were missing an opportunity, patterns of high school people going on to college. And there was some very interesting material came out of it. It was an interesting project because the people who worked on it, computers were just starting to come in then, and Joan Wilkie, who was a student at Wisconsin, and Mary Doyle, and Clarence Olmsted, and Mary was at Radcliffe, and Clarence was at Stanford, and he'd gotten tuned in to computers a little bit, I think it was that way, and then Jimmy Doyle didn't work for us, but Jimmy had been learning about computers, and these four were working on the project, and maybe Dick Halverson was too. And they put in hours beyond measure, far beyond what they were paid for, because they were trying to design the information so it could be handled through the computer. And they were bright kids, and they were interested in Wisconsin, and they did a good piece of work. And some of the things that I remember coming out of it with the fact that Forest County had a very small representation of people going on to college, and how poor they were in Forest County and the need up there, but that the people who went on to college usually turned out to be doctors or lawyers or something of that kind. They did something very outstanding, but not Calumet County, this very rich county east of Lake Winnebago, where there are a lot of very rich and able farmers, and it's an area out of which we got such people as Lewis Weeks and Harry Steenbuck and people of that kind of earlier years. Many of them were actually stopping with eighth grade educations because people were not believing that that was a good place. Well, we did some of that project that summer, mm-hmm. and it may have been funded from Rennebaum money. I don't remember, but it wasn't. We didn't see it as anything except an analysis to try to see what was happening in the high schools, and what. Well, the Red Star's admissions office used it, and I think we used it in some planning and extension of what we might be doing to bring into some of the counties that seemed to be underprivileged, mm-hmm. underrelated, underrepresented.
Well, that does sound like an interesting.
That was my pleasure of the summer. I remember some of the things we got out of it that were good, mm-hmm. that we used. But my pleasure was seeing these three who were hired, plus others they picked up, students just getting the greatest enthusiasm and doing a very excellent piece of work.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Well, knowing these people, mm-hmm. Myself, I'm not surprised mm-hmm. at what you say about them. Seems quite in character.
Oh, yes. And they apparently meet evenings at the Doyles and just have great arguments of how they were going to put this material together and how you could do it and what you had to do and what step you had to take next, which was a marvelous experience for them.
Oh, yes. I see so. Well, let's see. Now there's another activity of yours that I'd like to hear about is project that went on for about a year, I guess, in which you visited all the center campuses. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know how that originated, the plan for that, and what its purpose was, and what you got out of it.
Yes, all right. That was, my title, I guess, and by then was University Dean of Students. And Fred Harrington had in mind that we should be doing some of the same things on the center campuses and on the other campuses that we were doing in Madison, mostly in financial aid, but it could be in any area. In financial aid, in student government, in their, what do you call them, cultural programs, their speakers and their lectures and that kind of thing, how we could add in that dimension to student life. And to do that, he thought, someone from Madison ought to be visiting these campuses. So my schedule that year, as I recall it, was 1 week in Madison, 1 week at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, really, and then 1 week, the next week, out to some of the centers. So I'd be in Madison for a week, and then I'd go to Milwaukee. Some weeks I didn't spend a whole week in Milwaukee, 2 or 3 days, but we were doing the union over there and trying to put it together. We were developing a financial aid program over there. They were beginning to talk about dormitories. We were hiring people to do these jobs, and at Milwaukee, mostly I work with Mr. Plotchy and Mr. Joe Beyer and the rest of them there, in identifying people to bring in who could head a dormitory system, who could head a financial aid system, and really get that going. They were interested in counseling projects. In the centers, I worked with the people there largely, and that had more to do with how we could enhance the library program, the lectures program, music programs, so that the students got that richness on the center campuses that they were getting out of the four-year campuses. I got to know the center very well. I can remember spending time in Marinette and Marshfield, Kenosha, Racine. I often was President Harrington's representative at their Honors Day and so on. So not only did I go in and work with them and their programs, but I would come back for their celebrations and their occasions and their banquets and present awards. I learned a lot about Wisconsin. I learned a lot about personnel in the centers, where there were people who were being underutilized and what we could do with them and how we could help them. I learned where some of the sticking points were. And it was different at Racine from Marshfield, what people were interested in. And not too many people in the president's office, because Mr. Harrington was president of the whole center, or the whole university center. Mm-hmm. Not too many people knew too much about those. And so I suppose the advantages for the university out of it was that here was one person who had spent some time on all the campuses. who knew people there, that if you needed to find out about something, knew someone well enough to call, well, everyone knew the heads of the center system, but sometimes it isn't important enough to call the head about something, you want to find out what's going on or whether this would work. It also meant when decisions were being made in Dean's Council and so on, that people were reminded of the centers, and I was sometimes able to say, why don't we do this? I did a good deal of encouraging faculty from Madison to go out and do lectures and stay on the campus. So it was the building of a relationship that brought knowledge about the centers to the central administration and brought the resources of Milwaukee, Madison, and so on to some of the center system. And so, it was a very interesting experience for me, and I think very good at the time for the university.
Well, we haven't talked about what you just referred to as the fact that your title had changed, mm-hmm. and I'm aware that you went from being Dean of Women to Special Assistant to the President for a brief time.
And then university.
And then Dean of Students.
Mm-hmm.
And why this change? How did this evolve?
I think it evolved, what started it was my going to Fred, or to Mark Ingram, I think, and saying, I really don't think I want to be Dean of Women. There are parts of it, as I described it yesterday, of it that I just don't think I'm doing well. I think I can handle administrative. I think I can hire people who will do the work and get a kick out of it where I'm not and bring something to it. I think I don't want to do that, so I was going back to teaching math half-time. That was my idea. And I started auditing Mark Ingram's classes. Mark's response was, why don't you start teaching this fall? And I said I'd been away from teaching so long that I felt that I needed to take some time. And so I was auditing a couple of Mark Ingram's classes that fall. And it went very well the first couple months through September and October. And then one day Mr. Harrington said to me, I hear you don't think you've got enough to do in the Dean of Women's office. And he said, I feel there is a need that we're trying to centralize the administration of all the campuses. We've got people who work in the academic area. We've got people working in the financial area. We need someone working with the student kind of area and the student programs. And would you be interested in doing that? And I said, I might. And he said, well, his proposal would be that he bring me in as special assistant to the president for a while, mm-hmm. and let me find my way around and see what I thought could be done. And then if I wanted to make a recommendation on the job, I could to him, or he would decide in the meantime. So I started out as special assistant, and that I just did troubleshooting. Well, then I did start traveling, particularly to Milwaukee, because there was a lot going on in Milwaukee. And that year I spent more time at Milwaukee and dropped auditing classes and have never thought of teaching mathematics since. I had to go and tell Mark Ingram that I wouldn't be there anymore. And so that ended that, and I started doing the other thing. And it just sort of evolved out of the need of the university at the time. When I left, the position was not filled, but I don't think it needed to be filled. I don't think it really made sense to have someone doing that in that area after this first exploratory period, finding out what should be done.
I see. Well, then you became Dean of Student Affairs.
Yeah, well, the special assistant, then Dean of Student.
Went right into that within mm-hmm. less than a year, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and that was a position that wasn't filled when I was left. But I was really dean for all the campuses, and it had to be an administrative job. It couldn't be a job dealing with students because there were 55,000 students, and so you dealt
add them all together.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
But we tried to get some consistency in our programs, and so that we were doing somewhat the same thing.
In other words, getting the different campuses
mm-hmm. similar opportunities for students.
And well, do you feel that this was successful effort?
I think it was a successful effort. I think it was needed at the time that they were moving from independent campuses to a centralized administration. I think probably once we got personnel and an appreciation of what we needed to do in the different campuses in order that they could handle most of it themselves. They needed someone to refer to in medicine, but there always was someone they could refer to. But I think it was needed at the time. I don't think it was a position that was needed for me.
I've been wondering what the relationship was between what you were then doing as mm-hmm. student, as Dean for Student Affairs, and Joseph Kaufman, for instance, who was Dean,
he was Dean
of
the Madison
on the Madison campus.
Mm-hmm, yes.
How did these two jobs relate to one another?
Well, Joe Kaufman was the person in charge, administrator in charge in Madison campus, just as an old, goodness, I can't say his name. He came from Emory to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, was in charge on the Milwaukee campus. And their names are all gone, different ones on every one. These were the deans of students. Administratively, they were responsible. Joe was responsible to Bob Fleming, and the man at Milwaukee to Joe Clotchy. They worked for, they were men. But also, as they were responsible to me. Joe Kaufman's appointment, for instance. I recommend Joe's appointment to Bob Fleming. Found him, met him, interviewed him. Same thing at Milwaukee. They did the interviewing too, but I recommended the candidate. Sort of the way is describing house mother hire, you know, they worked for somebody else, but you worked with getting the right person. And certainly if Mr. Harrington wanted to know about the Dean of Students' responsibilities and jobs and problems and things at Madison in reference to Milwaukee, I was the person he turned to say, let's find out what's happening in these areas. And I had to be very careful in making sure that the chancellor on the campus didn't feel I was coming in and upsetting the apple cart. But I worked very closely with Joe Kaufman, and most of the policies that grew out, certainly I'd had a part in them. So his responsibility was to Mr. Fleming, but I was the Dean of Students that was coordinating all the programs and all the campus. Hmm.
So that's how that worked. I get the idea from what you said that the relationship with Harrington was an easy one.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the way, in fact, it was?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He is, he's one of the very, very easy people I've ever worked with. A great deal of confidence, or at least he seemed to have a great deal of confidence in what I was doing, and turned things over to me and expected me to do them. I enjoyed very much working with him and the kind of support that he gave.
In turning things over to you, did he give you somewhat of a free hand to
mm-hmm, very much
to operate?
Financial support when you needed financial support. I think the only time that I ever went to him with a request was for, those are the marvelous days when you dreamed up projects and want to go to the Ford Foundation and get a couple $100,000 to do something. And we had this marvelous project and we wanted to take it to the Ford Foundation. I can't even remember what it was now. And he said, I think it would be wiser if you go back and spend $500 of your own money and time and effort first to see if you can get this started. And he said, I'll give you $500,000, $2,000 to do a little work yourself to see if you can do these marvelous things. Then we'll go to Ford after we get, and I think this is the only time I had the greatest confidence when I went in with a proposal. And he's going to give me complete backing, and you know, we could go do it back to remember the state. And I remember we went back, and it may have been about careers or career studies or something of that kind. We went back and tried to do what we were going to ask for, and it just literally didn't work. You couldn't get people to do the things that we thought we'd get them to do in order to do the project. And it was another one of those things that just went down the drain like that. But, I didn't have the feeling that I had carte blanche to make mistakes if he saw there was going to be a mistake, if he knew this thing didn't work. I knew he was going to raise roadblocks and would be helpful in uh-huh. that sense. But if what you had to say, if what I had to say, what I recommended in appointments or in programs or so on, sounded sensible, He might say, here's where you're going to fail, and I might say, here's the risk we run. We talk about that part of it, but he was not afraid to run the risks. And so it was a good relationship. It wasn't just everything you do is right. Mm-hmm. There was always that critical mind helping you shape it up and sharpen it, but also the willingness to say, it's yours, and you take it and do it.
Which makes for
it was
working
I found
relationship.
A very easy person to work with. Like working, stimulated by.
This may be going back a little bit, but you said something about counseling a minute ago, and I realized I hadn't asked you how this function as Dean of Women and Dean of Students fit in with the activities of the counseling office, or the counseling and guidance.
We had a good friendly relationship, Ed Drake and Louise Leonard and Jane Mormon and all those folks, Larry Feinberg, Bill Thomas, knew them all
Emily
well.
Chervenick,
yeah. Emily Chervenick, yes. They recognized me as a person who was trained in their field, respected me. I knew what they were talking about, so it was an easy relationship. We worked together. I don't think of myself as a counselor. I have a PhD in that area. I understand what counseling is. I guess I learned out of it what kinds of problems you couldn't handle unless you were pretty skilled, which were the dangerous problems, which ones, you know, make some judgments there. But when you are an administrator, as I was, you're pushed for time, and you sometimes have to make decisions that are administrative. You don't very often have the time to work with a person, to work through their problems in the way you need to in mm-hmm. a counseling situation. And so I did, I used counseling techniques in talking with people, sure, getting them to talk and exchange, but as far as taking on the responsibility of here's an individual who's got a problem to work through and I'm going to be the counselor working through it, I didn't ever try to do that. And I don't think I'm much of a counselor, really, by temperament. I'm a teacher. And teaching and counseling aren't the same thing. As I, you know, as a teacher, I like to lay out what it is a person needs to learn and then get busy and teach it to them one way or another, sometimes by direct authority, sometimes by inspiring them to find out more. But I am a teacher more than a counselor, and I think if I hadn't gone into administration, I would never have become a full-time counselor, even though I had the...
Even though you studied it?
Studied
this
it
area.
And had it. I'm sure I would have come back to teaching. I see myself as an administrator, as a teacher. I had someone who worked for me at Barnard say, or it came back to me that she'd said about me, you go in and she tells you what she sees that needs to be done. She gives you some clues on how to do it, and she sends you away and just hopes to God you get it done. In a sense, that's teaching.
Yes.
That's the way you teach. And I had to laugh when someone came back and told me she had said this. And I thought, I've never heard a better description of administrator as a teacher rather than what you think of as administration. And I think I work more as a teacher always. I think that's where what I was.
Well, it sounds like it makes for effective administration, however, this method.
Well, when you finally learn to accept it for yourself.
Uh-huh.